Hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're streaming live on the web at kuci.org. Today's Wednesday, January 30th, 2019. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guest today for the entire hour is Pam Houston. Pam is the prize-winning author of Contents May Have Shifted and the short story collection Cowboys Are My Weakness, among other books. She is professor of English at the University of California, Davis, and lives on a ranch at 9,000 feet in Colorado, near the headwaters of the Rio Grande. She's here today to talk about her new memoir, Deep Creek, Finding Hope in the High Country, published by Norton. Hi, Pam.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you back. I think you were here with Contents May Have Shifted. That was the last time, and that was, what, 2012?
Yep, it was 2012.
Well, tell me about Deep Creek and how this memoir came about.
Well, after Contents, after I came back from the Contents tour, my editor said to me, you know, what I'd really like from you is a book-length adventure that you could go on and write about it. And so I thought about it. I thought about, you know, dog sledding to the South Pole or sailing the coast of Turkey or something that is in my bucket list of adventures that I'd like to do before I die. And then I was driving home from a quarter teaching at UC Davis, and the dogs were in the car, and they always get so happy when we get over to the leashless side of the Sierras. And I just thought, you know, my book-length adventure is buying this ranch for 5% down, breaking my neck to pay for it, and learning how to commit to a piece of land, to something, you know, that is going to be a lot of work and a lot of heartache and a lot of reward. That was sort of the unusual thing. Like, dog sledding to Antarctica would be sort of right up my alley. So that's how it came about. And I wrote a proposal and she liked it. And then I set about trying to find a form for that 25-year story of my love affair with the 120 acres to fit into.
Well, you know, one thing I took away from this book was how important it is to plow into fear instead of running from it. It seems that you found your place and your way in the world because you don't let fear stop you. And I find that just so, I don't know, envious. It's you're my hero.
Yeah.
Have you always been that way, or talk about that?
Well, I had... you know, I came from a pretty violent home. My father broke my femur when I was 4 years old, and I actually think he probably meant to kill me. And then I was afraid he would for a long time after that. I have been teaching writing so long, I have come to understand that that sort of garden variety domestic abuse. I mean, we had enough food to eat. We weren't homeless. You know, there were all kinds of things about my childhood that put it at probably about a 4 on the trauma scale and 1 to 10. But yet I had to do everything I did living in that fear that my father would hurt me or kill me. And, you know, so I got really good at compartmentalizing. I got really good at going ahead and doing the thing anyway, even though I was afraid. And then when I lived to get out of my parents' house, you know, I, of course, the way psychologists tell us we do, I recreated that situation as a whitewater river guide and extreme skiing and sheep hunting in Alaska and all the things I did to kind of, you know, recreate that danger and master it. So, yeah, I would say that's been the experience of my life. And as that applied to the ranch, of course, I bought 120-acre ranch for 5% down with no job and, you know, one little book in the world and not 3 pages of another book to rub together. So that was the way I lived on the edge there, you know. But the ranch taught me kind of the other side of that, like the reward of staying put and not running off to the next danger, I suppose. And, you know, the reward of hard work and routine and doing the same thing year in and year out and all kinds of things that I didn't have any experience with from my childhood.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, one of the criticisms I've heard of memoir is that the reader always feels that the author is leaving something out or holding back, that the truth is not entirely on the page, that through fiction you can better tell the truth. Yet your memoir feels so truthful. And I mean, yeah, you talk about your abusive father, you talk about what you went through at home. And so I'm curious if if there was, I don't know, decision on your part in terms of what to include and what to leave out. And it feels to me that you included it all.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. You know, it was a funny journey. I wrote the book, and the first draft of it was really about the ranch. I mean, it was all about hay and wood and sheep and horses, you know. It wasn't getting into much of my emotional state at all. I kind of had James Galvin's The Meadow as a model, and I just wrote deeply into the grasses. And then my agent read it, you know, 2 years ago now, and she said, isn't this the book where you really talk about what happened to you? And my first response was, dear God, like, have I done anything but? Like, it feels like that's all I've written about. And she said, not really. And I was like, oh, you know, because it was always couched in autobiographical fiction, or it was in metaphor, or it was in dream, or it was a cloudy memory written in italics, you know. And she was right. I'd never gone straight at it. And that wasn't because of fear, exactly. It was just because I like metaphor. I like the function of metaphor. I like putting the emotion into the physical object. To me, that's easier and often, as you just said, more powerful than talking about the emotional truth directly, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I tried, and it, you know, I do have, you know, both my parents are deceased, so that really gave me, I mean, people, you know, all my life I've heard people say, oh, well, you can write that story after your parents are dead, and I've thought, that's terrible advice. You should be able to write your story whenever you want. But the fact is, you know, the fact that both my parents are gone did make it easier to speak directly about what happened to me. But again, in the course of writing this book, I think I came to a useful difference between fiction and nonfiction to me. I've talked a lot in the past about how I don't find them very different, you know, at least in the creation of them. But I did in this case. I think in writing fiction, the action is really vertical. Like if you were to graph a short story or a novel, it would look like an EKG. Like you're going along and then the story explodes up or it dives down. And it's a very vertical action into like blowing apart a scene or detonating the surface into something deeper. And with the memoir, like, you know everything when it begins, so it's not explosive that way.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say you, I mean me, like the writer. For me, memoir was more like, it was more like water spreading out across a field and, you know, running into every little nook and cranny and rivulet. So it was more like a saturation instead of an explosion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think once I committed to that saturation, you know, I was kind of all in. Like, I wanted to be absolutely as naked and, you know, naked in my quest to really get at the emotional heart of it. Like, that became the challenge, which has never been a challenge. You know, that my challenges in the past have been, how can I find the best metaphor? Like, how can I write the scene so it's fast and funny and, you know, even darkly funny? Like, how can I make everything pop? And this book was not about popping. It was about soaking in.
You know, that's really interesting because in preparation for this interview this morning, I've been rereading Contents May Have Shifted and Stories in Cowboys Are My Weakness. And and I was going to talk about the difference in tone or difference in something. And I think maybe that's the difference. That may be the difference, where those books are fiction. And so you're doing something other than what you did here.
Yeah, I mean, obviously those books are autobiographical. I've made no secret of that, God knows. Like, for instance, calling myself Pam in Contents. But it is different. It's a really different process. And I didn't know how to write a memoir. I knew how to write personal essays, but I didn't know how to write a memoir before Deep Creek. And I learned that it's this slow irrigation. And that was terrifying to me because I like to be fast. You know, I like to be quick. I like to be fast. I like to change scene quickly. I like scenes to start in the middle and end in the middle. Like, I like everything to move, you know. So it was a real challenge to be still, which, of course, mirrors the challenge of owning the ranch.
You know, I read in an interview, speaking of your father, your parents, I read in an interview, I forget where, but with you, where you said Trump was like your father.
It's true. He is. He's almost replaced my father, you know, in my imagination. Some of the real similarities are the way that everything comes down to a financial equation. Everything's about money, even if it's babies in cages, you know, like everything's about money in the end. And if all the rest of us bleeding hearts weren't so stupid, we would see that. that's my father's attitude. Exactly. Also the way he kind of sneers, honestly, after the second debate where he coursed around the stage stalking Hillary like a shark, like I was in the fetal position for like 2 weeks. I mean, really, like that was so much like my father. But it's the way, you know, it's the constant assault as if he's trying to disprove that anything is good, you know, that if we were all honest with ourselves, we'd hate everything the way he does. That's the way they're the same.
Interesting. I would love to hear you read from Deep Creek. Could you do that?
Okay. I don't have it in my hand, but...
Well, if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Pam Houston. Her new memoir is Deep Creek, Finding Hope in the High Country, and it's published by Norton. And if you're in Orange County, next Tuesday, she will be at the Pen on Fire speaker series. There may be 3 seats left. So if you're interested, now would be the time to grab one of those. You can find out more on my website, penonfire.com.
How long would you like me to read?
Oh, I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes.
4 or 5 minutes?
Yeah, 3 to 5.
Okay. Let's do... I'm going to read... the way the book is laid out is there are longer chapters that make up the bulk of the book, that how I got to the ranch and what happens at the ranch and how I almost lost the ranch and the big fire that threatened the ranch, et cetera, et cetera. And then between those bigger chapters, the form of this book is loosely an almanac or a calendar. And there are 12 sections called Ranch Almanac, and they sort of chart the ranch through the year. And those passages are a little more lyrical, a little prettier, and they're really about the ranch workings. Chopping wood, buying hay, lambing. And this is one of those. This is one called Carving Rivers. Today I'll spend 3 hours carving rivers through ice with a pointed shovel and a maul, and by the day's end I'll have the blisters to prove it. It's to do with DeSeo, who finds all manner of things scary and off-putting, purple buckets, flapping jackets, the wind whispering through the pines. The trough where the horses drink in winter is at the end of the pasture where all the water from the snowmelt drains toward Lime Creek. The trough is there because that's where the frost-free hydrant is. And the frost-free hydrant is there because it's the closest point to the house from which the water originates. The longer the line from the house to the frost-free hydrant, the higher the chance of the system freezing, and then we go back to hauling water again. Unfortunately, when we get into the freeze and melt portion of the winter, which can last from early March to mid-May, a pond develops around the trough, which turns into a skating rink every time the temperature dips below 30, which is to say, every single night. And to DeSeo, a skating rink surrounding a horse trough might be the scariest thing of all. When DeSeo doesn't drink, his metabolic condition gets worse. When he refuses to cross the ice, I carry a bucket of water out to him. Sadly, then, the bucket becomes the object of his fear. I can leave it on the ground and walk away to prove it is neither strange nor alive. I can float little bits of carrot on the surface of the water to make it more enticing. I can even get on my hands and knees and pretend to slurp some of the water up into my mouth myself, but he simply won't have it. He feels there is only one designated safe place to drink in this pasture, and that is the water trough now booby-trapped by a non-negotiable platform of ice. So I wait until the temperature crawls above freezing, about noon, and head to the pasture with my tool. The sun has felt truly warm all week, but this ice that formed on the bottom of what used to be deep snow has had a good 4 months of sub-zero to harden. I jump up and down as hard as I can and kick at it with my steel-toed boots and about detach my arms from my shoulder blades, wielding them all over my head to shatter the surface. This part is fun, how it must feel to break a car's windshield. Once pits and cracks begin to form, I dig little tributaries into the ice with the tip of my shovel. In about 30 minutes, it has warmed up a few more degrees, and I get a satisfying little trickle to flow downhill out of the skating rink, around the trough, and into the yard. I hack some more, the thermometer ticks up another degree, and the water does what water does best, gives in to gravity. I follow it, assisting with a few hacks of my shovel all across the front of my property. Before too long, I have the world's smallest river flowing from the bottom of my pasture all the way across the yard and into Lime Creek. I watch the creek water tumble toward the Rio Grande, imagining it running past the town of Creed and then through Wagon Wheel Gap, down the canyon and across the San Luis Valley, through the box near Taos, eventually forming the border between Texas and Mexico and flowing into the Gulf. I am filled with a completely disproportionate sense of satisfaction. For a second, I understand why those guys were crazy enough to think they could build the Panama Canal. I return to the trough and hack my way to another tiny river, and then another one, learning quite a bit about the various properties of water and ice in the process. Once I get the little rivers started, for instance, they deepen and widen and hasten on their own, just like I learned in geology class. 2 cubic feet per second turn into 20 with a little more sun and a little more coaxing. In 3 hours, I have 10 outlet rivers carved into the ice surrounding the trough, and I am starting to develop blisters on my blisters. But the sun is still up, and the snow is in the forecast, and I love my old nervous horse, so I cut 5 more rivers around the far edges of the ice, just in case the pond gets even bigger.
Thank you so much. That was Pam Houston reading from Deep Creek. Your setting is, well, your animals are characters. I love the donkeys. And the setting is such a character. And you're so great at setting and all those visceral details. And, you know, writers say that they have to be away from a place to be able to write about it. It doesn't seem to be the case for you.
No, I've never said that. What they say about me is Pam writes 11 seconds behind her life. No, I can write while I'm there. I mean, the ranch is so much a part of me now. I can also write when I'm not there. But I like to write when I'm looking out the window at it. It actually helps me.
And I recall from when you were on before or when you were at the speaker series for Contents May Have Shifted that you talked about liking to write on airplanes, that it was something like, you know, in the last 45 minutes, you get some of your best writing done. Is that still the case?
Yeah, it still is. I still have that rule. You know, I the way all my stories get made is that I collect these things I call glimmers from my lived experience of the world, the natural world, but also the Walmart world, you know, whatever world. And I record those. It's when I recognize something in the exterior landscape, it's going to unlock a story in my interior landscape. I can feel it. And so can you, so can everyone, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like you see a thing and you go, oh wow, that was amazing. You know, whether it's just the way the light's hitting a river, or whether it's something a mother says to her kid at the grocery store, or whether it's one for me that I wound up just using in a story is a frozen bottle of Ketel One on a caterer's table that had a dozen red roses frozen into the ice. I collect those things. And then when I'm on the plane, just because I'm on planes so often and I need a regular time to do this, and for me sort of the most regular thing is being on a plane, I will I'll just do what I think of as a glimmer dump, and I'll just sit on the plane and get all those things into my computer, all those glimmers that I've, these things I've noticed lately. And then when it's time to sit down and write, I'll comb through them and see which ones want to come out and play. And, you know, in writing the ranch book, especially the first draft of the ranch book, you know, I just basically looked through all my glimmers that took place on or around the ranch over the years, which there were literally hundreds of them in my computer.
So also then, in terms of, you know, what you said a little earlier about those interstitial pieces between the chapters, the almanac type pieces, how did the structure come about and how did you decide to place them there?
Well, my original, you know, I tend to like to know the size of the boxes I'm filling. Like, it makes me feel really comfortable as a writer. I don't need to know the aboutness. I don't need to know what I'm writing about. I don't know what the end is. I don't know what I don't need to know what it means. I don't need to know where it's going. What I love to know is the shape of it, the physical shape of it. And in Contents May Have Shifted, that was a 12-sided Rubik's Cube. And that idea of a 12-sided Rubik's Cube basically made that book happen. Mm. Honestly, I couldn't have done it without it. This book was a lot more wobbly in terms of form. Like, I started right out with the idea of a calendar, the idea of an almanac. I started out trying to make chapters that were called January, February, March, etc. And it just got too confusing, especially after I decided to bring the childhood stuff in and bring in the stuff about climate change. Like the bigger the book got, the further the book went away from simply being about the ranch, the harder it was to stick to the calendar and have it make sense. So I abandoned that idea. And then much later in the writing process, I looked at what I had, and I could see that I had a lot of these longer chapters, and then I had these shorter, more lyric chapters. And that's when I realized that they could be the almanac, like they could be the calendar, so that the other chapters could range across years and across time and didn't necessarily have to fall chronologically, as long as I kept chronology with the months of the year and the almanac pieces. And it was funny. When you're organizing a book toward the end, you know, I was trying to get everything right, and I obviously didn't want, you know, like this horse couldn't come along until the other horse died, or, you know, I wasn't trying to adhere to chronology exactly. I was trying not to disrupt the reader by throwing a wrench at them, you know. So I couldn't solve this one problem, and it was that one of the short almanac pieces is about the Perseid meteor shower, and which happens every August, and I couldn't get it into August. Like, I couldn't make the chapters work, and so I solved it by changing it to the Leonid meteor shower, which is in November, and I rewrote it. And I've seen, you know, both of those meteor showers many times, so it wasn't hard to rewrite it. But I thought that's a funny writing solution.
That's interesting.
Change the meteor shower to get it in the right place in the calendar year.
Hmm. Well, we're going to take a really short break, allow you to grab some water, and we'll be right back with more Pam Houston. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Ooh.
such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Oh, honey, just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby, I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, my love, my whole world turns misty blue.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm with Pam Houston, and let's bring her back on. So I wanted to also talk a little bit about process in terms of, you know, once you know the shape of the book, once you knew what Deep Creek was going to look like, do you barrel through? Do you write chronologically? Do you outline? Do you do any of that?
No, I don't do any of that.
Oh, good.
I definitely don't outline. The very word outline kind of makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. I write in pieces. You know, I write the things that feel hot, the things that feel most important. And I write them, you know, it's sort of an extension of the glimmers, right? Like I write the scene I know goes in, even though I haven't set it up. You know, I write that scene, and then I write another scene, and then I write another moment, and then I describe another beautiful thing, and then I describe another animal death or whatever. And I get those pieces, and then I bring them together as they want to go. But even in this book, which is going to seem very linear to my readers compared to, for instance, Contents, even in this book, I was still moving chunks of it around at the final hour. an essay that I've been reading on tour called The Season of Hunkering Down, it's the third chapter, and it's an amalgam of all these orphaned pieces that fell out of other chapters, and they actually work together, and they make a really nice bridge between the first part of the book and the rest of the book. And I was putting those hunks of it together really just before the last big turn-in, you know, before reading for typos and that kind of thing. So I do think of all books as kind of a bundle of infinitely movable, infinitely divisible pieces. And then it's like a puzzle I'm solving.
Is that how you teach writing memoir?
I teach my glimmers, you know, I try not to teach like one method, but I do have everyone write glimmers and then I make them, you know, choose four of them and put them together in a story. So I guess I do. Yes, I do. I mean, I teach all different level of memoirists, you know, so if someone comes to me with an almost completed memoir and they've done it a completely different way, that's perfectly fine with me. But teaching beginning memoir, absolutely, you know, or teaching people who just have a story to tell and they don't know how to tell it, I would recommend that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then how do you balance caring for the ranch, teaching, and writing? Because, you know, I hear a lot of excuses why people are not getting their writing done, and it would seem to me that you have like a million things going on at every moment.
Well, it did take me 6 years to write this book, so I'm not writing very fast. And I do teach a lot, and I love to teach. Like, teaching has really become the center of my life, and helping these other voices, these younger voices, voices of young women, voices of underserved communities. I teach at the Institute of American Indian Arts, and I was one of Tommy Orange's mentors, just to name one. So many amazing books coming out of that program. To me, that's the really valuable way I'm taking space up on the planet, is by making and holding a space for those younger writers. I really mean that. It's incredibly satisfying to me in a way that, you know, my relationship with my own books are very complicated and overall good, but, you know, it's like pure joy to have one of your students bring a book into the world. You know, it's not complicated with the kinds of self-loathing we always heap on ourselves. Mm. So I teach a lot. The ranch, I have a lot of help. There's a sort of unofficial residency where students that I meet either at Davis or at IA or elsewhere come to the ranch the year after they graduate to finish their books and help me with the animals. And that's become a really wonderful part of my life, too. So I do get a lot of help at the ranch, and I am free to leave to teach and to work in other ways. I feel guilty, you know, if something goes wrong or somebody gets sick and I'm not there. But so that's the way I balance that. And, you know, I'm a workaholic and I don't sleep very much. I mean, that's the other way I do it. Mm. But I'm getting older, so I'm going to have to try to recommit to a little more sleep.
Mm. So were there points in this book where you just sort of hit a wall? Or do you just, is it just on? Is it always on for you that you can, you just find a way around that, or that it just doesn't occur that there is a sticking point or a place where you just don't know how you're going to get through it?
Oh, that definitely occurs. I mean, I hit so many walls in this book more than ever because I wasn't relying on my old tricks. I wasn't relying on metaphor and fast scene change. I was trying to stay in that field with the water spreading across it. You know, I was trying to be still, and that was hard because I'm so afraid to be boring. So I hit many walls. I hit a big wall about 100 pages in, which I always do. And then I may as well, like, you know, go play the slot machines for 6 months because nothing's going to happen, you know, and I just kind of know that about myself. I roar into a book and I think, oh, this one's going to go so fast. And then bang, you know, that always happens. But in this book, you know, it was a really different book for me. I don't know if it'll seem that way to my readers because, you know, there's a lot of the same themes in it that I usually write about, but process-wise, it was very different. And I think the nature of it is different. And I think, as I said, the level of nakedness is different. And And it just took a long time. And there were many times. There were at least three times in the course of the 6 years where I just thought, okay, I was wrong. I don't have it. I don't have this book. I really don't have it. And I thought that for, you know, not an afternoon. I thought that for a few months. So this one was a real struggle. And then my agent didn't, or my editor didn't think that I had written the book I had proposed to. So then we had to struggle with that. So, and I thought I had, you know, and I think her opinion was valid and mine was valid, but we didn't agree. And there were this book of all the books I thought I would lose one way or the other. Hmm. Either Norton wouldn't publish it or I just couldn't finish it or I would realize that I hadn't done what I tried to do. And like this book seemed destined for calamity more than any other book, really the whole time. And the fact that people are really liking it and the fact that it got all these great starred pre-publication reviews and all this stuff, like it's like gravy because I was just so happy it exists between covers, you know, that I can hold it. And so all the lovely things that are happening to it right now are such a bonus, you know, and I guess, you know, that figures. I mean, the thing, you know, that there's some sort of equation in the universe, like the one you really thought you lose, you would lose would be, would turn out to be the really good news, you know, in the end. But no, I mean, I struggle every day as a writer with all the same things all writers struggle with, you know. Oh, shut up. Nobody cares. Why would anybody care about your story? God, haven't you told that story anywhere? People are so sick to death of you. Aren't you so sick of your own voice? I mean, all those voices. Very present to
That's
me all the
interesting.
Time.
So have you felt that? Well, it sounds like you haven't felt that way to this extreme with your other books. In terms of it's not going to make
I
it.
I think and... those naysaying... self-hating voices are my friend Fenton Johnson, the writer, calls that the price of admission. You know, I think if you don't have those voices, then, you know, for one thing, you're an asshole. You know? but I think, I do think it's the price of admission. I mean, I don't know. I know so many writers. All my friends are writers now, or mostly all my friends. And there's not one of us that doesn't really, really wrestle with, you know, those questions in every book. It was just that this book, I was out on a limb in this book in a way that I haven't been lately. I would say that just because I was trying to write in a way, I was trying to be generous, letting myself feel on the page, letting myself think on the page, not always letting the metaphor stand in for the emotion, which is really my safe place. And so it just seemed more likely that it would fail, even before it got to publication, let alone once it came out.
Do you have readers before it gets to your editor?
No. Well, yes, a couple. I have readers who do different things at different times, and sometimes I ask them to read it before I send it to my editor. I mean, I have always, I was... edited by Carol Houck-Smith for years at Norton and now Elaine Mason. And both of those editors, as you know, comparatively are extremely hands-on. I mean, I always expect that we're going to go through draft after draft after draft together. So for me, there's no like, oh, I want to get it perfect, you know, before I send it to them because they're going to have a lot to say no matter what. Sometimes I let people read it right before I send it to them. More often I get the first set of notes and then I give it to some friends to read, you know, to see how their read lines up with the notes, the editorial notes I got. So yeah, I have friends that I exchange with, not a lot of them. And again, for different things, you know, like one friend is a grammarian, you know, one friend is going to love it and boost my confidence. Another one is going to like call me out on every single time I'm not, say, self-implicating enough or something, you know, different readers that I know will give me different kinds of feedback.
Were there writers or authors that influenced you when you were a kid?
When I was a kid? Sure.
Yeah. Who?
Oh, gosh. Well, when I was a kid, when I was a little kid, there was The Secret Garden, mm-hmm. and there was a Dr. Seuss book called On Beyond Zebra, where there were 26 letters after Z, and it was all about the creatures you could make with those 26 letters. And, like, that was a big book for me. Weirdly enough, Mrs. Pigglewiggle was a big book. I think of Mrs. Pigglewiggle all the time. And the funny thing about that is, in that writer who wrote Mrs. Pigglewiggle, she put adverbs in every single dialogue attribution. Like, she said meaningly. And that word meaningly, that's like a double down adverb. It's almost like an adverb squared. But and I'm always like, get the adverb out of your work.
Right.
Especially out of dialogue attribution. So that was the stuff when I was a kid. As I got a little older, like, the modernists were super important to me in high school and college, like Lawrence and Wolfe and mm-hmm. Joyce. And then as I got into grad school and started thinking about becoming a writer, probably the two biggest ones were Alice Munro and Toni Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
Those were probably, and again, I don't write anything like either of them, but they were my inspiration.
Yeah.
And then writers, I tried a little harder to emulate, and because I could see what they were doing, as opposed to, say, Toni Morrison. Laurie Moore was important. Amy Hempel,
mm-hmm.
you know, my sort of immediate elders. Ron Carlson, mm-hmm. I learned a lot about story writing from him.
Mm-hmm. And then how did you come to the West? I mean, because you grew up on the East Coast, and... How did that happen? What was the trigger? What was the inspiration? Do you remember?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I read, when I was in college, I read all the books of Edward Abbey. I think so many people in my generation were drawn west by his books.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there was this guy in our neighborhood when I was a little kid, called Colonel Bob Miller, who took all the neighborhood kids camping.
Mm.
And he made us, for a weekend every summer, and he made us ride in the back of station wagons, and he made us ride under blankets, and he told us we were going west. And he would, like, say, oh, there goes the Mississippi River. And then he'd screech the car to the stop, and he'd get permission from the chief to enter the reservation land, you know. And he put this whole thing on for us every summer. And we were only going to, like, the city park, essentially, like to a wild part of the city park in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. But, you know, he made us believe that we were going out west. And those weekends were my favorite weekends of my childhood, pretty much. And I kept going, and I came back years later to be like a overseer, like I want to say counselor, but it wasn't that formal, you know, just like one of the adults who watched over the little kids in the woods. In Monocacy Park. And I really think, like, the more I think of it, like, I think that idea that the West was the place, and the West was where I was going to be happy, and the West was where I was going to find safety. Like, I think a lot of it started with Colonel Bob.
Hmm. Does he know?
He's deceased, but I think he did know. He did it for 25 years or 30 years. Like, I think he knew. I mean, who knows how much he knew? Like, did he know all the terrible things that were going on in all those little tucked-in suburban houses? And did he know that, like, his weekends were hope? Maybe.
Hmm.
Maybe he did. Or maybe he just liked to go out, and he just liked kids, and his kids were grown, so he took us. You know, I don't know.
Speaking of hope, of course we have to talk about this because, you know, we're kind of living in a worrisome time, and your book contains a lot of hope. And mm-hmm. so maybe talk about that. And did you know that was going to be a part of your book, sort of the message, one of the messages when you were starting out?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think hope is... I mean, I think life becomes impossible without hope. I always think of that Jane Hirschfield line, hope is the hardest love we carry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really profound. And I mean, I did, the title was the very, very, very last thing and the subtitle was even after that. So I didn't know the word hope was going to be in the title, but I do think the book is about hope, and I think it has never been more important to hold on to hope. First of all, because of the way the current administration is trying to take it away from us at every single hour, the way we're being assaulted with, we're being shamed for our hope. And then also because it may be too late, you know, to save the planet. It may be, or at least to save us on the planet. The planet will probably do better once we're gone. But to, you know, with climate change, the center of this book is about how do we hold on to the hope and keep our eyes open about the devastation. Like, how do we remain joyous when we see 800 narwhal off the bow of our boat in the Arctic, knowing that it's almost over for the narwhal or the polar bear? Or how do we appreciate the beauty of the 5-mile square ice sheet that we ran into, knowing that it fell off of Greenland and it's the biggest literal biggest piece of evidence we have of climate change? We have to be big enough to hold both of those things simultaneously, because that's all that's left. It's never going to be like, oh, it's all okay. We're not going to have the kind of hope that, like, a lot of people in this country had 30 years ago, a lot of white people in this country had 30 years ago. We're not going to, you know, we're going to have to be realistic about what it's going to look like going forward. And there's a lot of despair, and maybe it'll make us kinder. Maybe it'll make us more aware of the people who haven't ever had hope because of the circumstances they grew up in. I don't know. You know, I think it has the potential to be a really powerful, rich, sad, beautiful time. Mm. But it's not going to be easy.
Yeah. Well, there's so much more to talk about. Fortunately, you'll be down here next week and we can talk more, because I wanted to talk to you about the title and the cover and all sorts of things. But in any case, any sort of last words for the writers listening?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. Pay attention to the world around you with your senses. Pay attention with all your senses. And the other thing is, you know, I went to grad school. Probably a lot of people listening went to grad school. And, it's been a long process of my understanding that it's more important to be honest than clever, and it's more important to be kind than smart. Mm-hmm. And if I could have told my young writer self something, I would have tried to convince myself of that a little earlier. And that's kind of another thing this book is doing, and that's why it's so scary. I think you see that in a lot of writers' careers. You see them getting over graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
and I feel like I took a step in that direction with this book.
Mm. Thank you so very much for being here, and I look forward to next week.
Yeah, me too. It'll be fun to be down there. I look forward to it, too. Thank you.
You're welcome. That was Pam Houston. Her book is Deep Creek, Finding Hope in the High Country, published by Norton. And again, if you want to see her down here in Orange County next week, go to my website, penonfire.com, and you can find out more. That's all we have for you today. We're here every Wednesday at 9 Pacific time. And this show, along with hundreds of others, are podcast on iTunes. If you go to iTunes and search out Writers on Writing, you will find it. Subscribe. And when we podcast shows, they will land in your podcast file. Thanks so much for being with us. And we'll see you right back here next week.